Stand by for another exciting edition of the Lunch Special.
In the hen house other night, awful dark, I didn't have no light. I reached for a chicken, I got me a goose. A man come out, I had to turn him loose. I jumped the gully,
he shall be free.
I jumped a rose bush,
he shall be free.
Got some plow ground,
he shall be free. Well, the good Lord set you free.
Now let Billy
begin to root the head of chicken.
Down in the hen house on my knees, I thought I heard a chicken sneeze. Only a rooster saying his prayers, thanking his God for the hens upstairs. He's a preaching,
you shall be free.
He's a singing,
you shall be free.
Taking up collection,
you shall be free.
When the good Lord set you free.
Oh, some folks send it to them hearts. In my hogs,
you shall be free.
In that hog eye,
you shall be free.
In them chitlin,
you shall be free. Where the good Lord set you free.
As some people say, preacher won't steal, but I caught two down in my cornfield. One had a bushel, other had a peck, other had a roast near down his neck. Here's a good chill.
You shall be free.
Get the roast near.
You shall be free.
Get dried corn.
You shall be free.
Well,
the good Lord set you free.
Oh, the gun said boom and the horn set me up. He jumped on it with all he hit me up. Put on his overcoat, I hung it on the rail.
I don't care.
You shall be.
Forget about the children.
You shall be free. Where the good Lord set you free.
Now, sonny.
And welcome to another edition of the Lunch Special here, heard every Monday from noon to one with another Stanford personality, I must say. And it could be from any department, any level. We've had the cops on here, the mayor of a couple of towns, and today from the physics department. It's about time we got some folks from over there back. Former station manager here at KZSU and talk show host herself, Miss Catherine Todd, my old buddy.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here.
We're so glad to have you back. It's how long has it been gone since you've been gone? How long has it been since you've been gone?
I think it's 3 years since I've been a regular here.
And we all miss you.
Yeah.
And you always did such a great job around here, not just as a station management, but you had a great show that you put together that you did a lot of work. You put a lot of work into. You really, it was one of those, it could have been aired on NPR. Could have been aired. Well, it was aired here.
Well, yeah, that show was a lot of work, yeah.
You did great interviews with people. You really got in depth and a lot of cutting and splicing and editing too, right?
Oh, well, now you're embarrassing me.
Okay.
But, you know, that splicing is cool. It's really addictive, actually, because, you know, you see the waveforms going on and you realize you can make people say stuff that they didn't say. It's always really tempting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And this coming from a physics department person here at Stanford. So, we're going to get into your role here at Stanford and how you got there and what you do here. And it's pretty heavy stuff, too. We've been talking about it off mic. But we do want to play some music for the folks. Now, who was that we just played?
So Kevin. That was Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly. A lot of people have heard of Woody Guthrie, I bet, out there. Leadbelly is maybe a little bit less well-known, but he was one of the really early blues greats. And they were singing this song that I love to listen to. It's in my personal collection, but it's such a strange song, and I've always wondered about it. And that's why I really wanted to play it here today, because I know, Bird, that you have a blues show here, a great blues show. And
oh, thank you.
And you know a lot more about this song than I do. And can you explain it to me? It is so strange.
I've never heard that song before in my life. As far as Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly, I think they're more associated with folk music mm-hmm. than they are with blues. Mm-hmm. Leadbelly always ends up in the blues section of record stores and even in our library here, and I've kind of wondered about it because Leadbelly was more of a folk guy. He was a guy that could play any kind of music at all. Hmm. Guys like him that played on the street, primarily, he didn't play nightclubs. They had to learn how to play anything.
Hmm.
You know, kind of like an eclectic DJ,
mm-hmm.
you know, someone who would not be an expert on one genre, but know a lot about mm-hmm. a little bit about a lot of genres.
Because people are asking you to you know, play this or play that
right.
out on the street.
Right. And then Woody was a traveling troubadour
mm-hmm.
who was an activist, too. So to have I'd never heard those two sing together before. Where did you find that?
You know, that is my folks are big Woody Guthrie fans, and my mom has this huge Woody Guthrie compilation.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah, and this song is on it. It's I think that's the only one on that compilation, at least, that's with Leadbelly.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of your folks, I heard they got mentioned. You recently made an appearance on our philosophy professor's show entitled "Opinions" by Robert Harrison. You were on there with him, right?
Oh yeah. Well, that was recorded a long time ago. It might have been.
Oh, he just aired
more
it
recently.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And So you made a recent appearance here at KZSU Airwaves.
Without even knowing it, yeah.
And your parents came up with the conversation, didn't they?
I guess we did talk about it. We were talking about Thoreau, and I was basically saying that I thought that Thoreau was sort of intellectually dishonest, or that, you know, his idea was that in order to really be a good person, or to like become who you were really supposed to be, you had to get away from the corrupting influence of the world. And I was taking issue with that. I was saying, well, you know, who raised that man, right? You know, I mean, that I didn't think that the way to become who you were really supposed to be was to get away from the influence of other people, that you were supposed to be a part of a community, and that to become who you really needed to be, you needed to acknowledge your connection to and dependence on all the people around you.
And how did your parents come up in the conversation?
Well, they had a sort of Thoreauvian life, right? They were young in the 1960s, and they met in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They were both at the same time, without having met each other, scheming about sort of getting away from it all in this Thoreauvian way to, you know, go out into the country and, you know, be on your own land and raise your own food. And my mom had a surplus mail van at the time. You know, the post office had been selling off some of their extra old vehicles, and she had this mail van, and it had some rust in the side panel, so she was looking for some sheet metal to patch it.
Mm-hmm.
And she you know, Cambridge, Mass is not the best place in the world to find sheet metal. It's not
probably not.
Yeah. So she passed by this store styling itself Earth Guild. And the sign said, "We sell everything." So she thought, okay, you know, maybe they have sheet metal. And she went inside, and they had, like, you know, hemp twine and candles and stuff. But mm-hmm. it was a slow day, and she got to chatting with the woman behind the counter, and the woman said, "Well, you know, we don't have sheet metal, but we do have Sam, and he drives a mail truck, too, and maybe you'd like to meet him."
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so that's how they met. And, you know, after a while, they, you know, combined mail trucks and went off to live out their Thoreauvian life together. But it wasn't about, I mean, they came to this rural community and they became part of the community. You know, my dad ran the water and the irrigation district, and my mom taught Sunday school. And it was about getting away from some of the things that they thought were pernicious in, you know, in American life at that time. But it wasn't about getting away from other people.
Mm-hmm. Are they still doing it?
Well, you know, they live where they used to live, but they're not raising chickens anymore.
Very cool. Catherine Todd is our guest for the hour. Former station manager here at KZSU. Not too long ago either. Just you've only been gone a couple of years. And had a great talk show here too. And brought some wonderful music down. Why don't we play some more?
All right. So, this next song is the same but different from the last one.
How is it the same and how is it different?
All right. Well, so it's, you know, I mean, we can argue folk or blues, but I think that the last song is a little bit in the blues tradition.
Okay.
And it's, I don't think you can get much more authentic than Lead Belly, really. I mean, he was, you know, he was like playing the music of his own tradition, the tradition that he was helping to make. And this next song was recorded by the Rolling Stones. And, I like this song. I love this song. I grew up listening to this song. And I think it's a good song, but it's, makes me a little bit uncomfortable, you know,
because
this is not Mick Jagger's natural vernacular. I don't know. Let's listen to it, and then we can talk about it.
Well, I followed her to the station. With a suitcase in my hand, yeah, I followed her to the station. With a suitcase in my hand. Whoa, it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell. When all you love. Cry.
the Rolling Stones here, early Rolling Stones here on KZSU's Lunch Special with Catherine Todd, the and now the postdoc in the physics department. That means you're working on a physics projects here at Stanford. But let's talk about that song.
Yeah, we were just arguing about it. I
hope we weren't arguing, but do you like that song
discussion.
Or do you not like that song?
I love that song.
Oh, that's I love that song too.
But I feel a little bit bad about loving it.
Why do you feel bad about loving that song?
Well, I mean, there were people who built the blues tradition.
African Americans.
Yeah, here in the U.S. out of the experiences that they had, which were hard experiences.
Sure.
And not that many people listened to their music. They
were marginalized. They weren't allowed to be on the mainstream radio.
That's right. And they didn't make a lot of money playing their music.
They were ripped off.
Yeah. And then Mick Jagger, you know, he listens to their music and he likes it. And now he's singing in the blues tradition. But I mean, where does
well, you're
that...
talking about 40 years ago, right?
Well, yeah, okay. This
is kind of history.
That's right, yeah.
But yeah, at that time it wasn't now, for sure.
And he's, you know, profiting wildly from being a, like, conduit of this experience that isn't really his, you know? I mean, he...
At that time, 40 years ago, he wasn't profiting wildly. He later did go on to become a multimillionaire, but at that time... He wasn't making a ton of money from that stuff, but so what angsts you about this?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
you think he ripped him off?
I guess I feel like a lot of what's so powerful about music is understanding other people's emotions, right? Understanding what's going on inside the head of the person who's performing that music.
Do you think he did?
Well, I don't know if he felt that way, but I feel like he didn't. How could he have felt that way? I mean, he didn't live that life. He graduated from the London School of Economics, right? I'm waiting for the tube and, you know, wishing that my girlfriend hadn't left me. It's not quite the same.
Okay. So now we know how Catherine Todd feels about the song she loves and how Mick Jagger presented it. I'm not going to argue with you. No, if anything, we'll have a little discussion. But no, I think that's beautiful. I think it's wonderful that someone like you, a physics person who's completely delved into this other world, into the physics world, and you got your PhD in that. What did that take? That took years, right? That you have such an interest in this great American art form they call it's, and you love not just blues, but folk. And I think you have the same kind of love that guys like Mick Jagger had. You hear music that strikes you somewhere.
Oh, touche. So you're like, how can you, sitting down in your basement soldering, really understand the blues experience?
I didn't mean it that way. Not at all. I think it's interesting that someone could have those dual loves, because usually somebody who's into something as heavy as physics, what you're in, and at the bottom of the hour, in just a little bit, we're going to find out what you're exactly into here at Stanford, but somebody who's so heavy into that and who spent so much of your life studying that has this other love that's and you know, yeah, I do have a blues show here, and you are very well versed in what you're talking about. You know what you're talking about, and a lot of what you said I've said on the air here too. I've carried a torch for the blues for a long time and said that, you know, I'm very opposed to anybody taking it and stealing it and not paying tribute. I feel this. I agree with you 100% if that's what they're doing. It's very hard to figure out, though, sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm. You don't think that that's what they're doing,
though. Well, we don't. I don't know if I can. We'll just take up too much time trying to define that today. And you brought some great music, so let's play some more, and we'll see if we can answer one of those questions.
All right. Well, here is a song, a blues song or a folk song that I kind of hate. And, you know, we
Is it? Do you love it, too?
Oh, no. I love the song, but I hate the rendition, and we can...
And why are we playing it, then?
Well, I want to talk about it. Okay. We don't have to listen to the whole thing if you get bored.
It's your show, babe. Whatever you want to do.
One day, sir, I was walking along, and I heard that special singing a lonesome song. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. people at the midnight special. Shine her ever-loving light on me, yonder come little Rosie. How in the world do you know? I can tell her by her apron and the dress she wore, umbrella on her shoulder, a piece of paper in her hand. She goes a-marching to the captain, says, I'm wanting my man, let the midnight special shine a light on me. Oh, let the midnight special shine her ever-loving light on me. Now you go down to Houston, boy, you better walk right. Boy, you better not stagger, and you better not fight. Oh, Sheriff Benson will arrest you, he'll take you down. And if the jury finds you guilty, your penitentiary bound. Oh, let the midnight special shine a light on me. Oh, let the midnight special shine a ever-loving light on me. Now you wake up in the morning, you hear the ding-dong ring. You go marching to the table, you see the same damn thing, a knife and fork are on the table, and nothing in my pan. And if you say anything about it, you're in trouble with a man. Oh, let the midnight special shine her light on me. Oh, let the midnight special shine her ever-loving light on me. Now, old Hughie Ledbetter, he was a mighty fine man. Hughie taught me this song to the whole wide land. But now he's done with all his grieving, whooping, hollering, and crying. Now he's done with all his studying about his great long time. I'll let the midnight special shine a light on me. I'll let the midnight special shine a ever-loving light on me. Oh, let the midnight special shine a light on me. Oh, let the midnight special shine a ever-loving light on me.
Here with music critic Catherine Todd. Just kidding. Pete Seeger just turned, I think, 95, and they had a big they had his birthday party at Madison Square Garden, and everybody was there. And that was Pete Seeger doing the Midnight Special. Now, Catherine, you brought that song, and you mentioned before we played it that you what?
I hate that song.
Okay, why did we play it?
Well, it's about this question of like authenticity in music, right? I mean, Pete Seeger.
Did you feel Pete wasn't being sincere?
No, I don't. I don't think that.
Oh,
but I guess that he
not authentic.
Yeah, not authentic. I guess. I mean, in a way, he's hyper authentic, right? One of his life's projects was to catalog all of this folk and blues music and keep it from being lost
and bring it to a bigger audience.
Yeah, and he has lengthy, like multi-album recordings where he's just one after another. You know,
kind of a musicologist.
Yeah, exactly. He's like a musicologist or even an anthropologist, a historian trying to like preserve this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But this recording offends me.
Why?
It's
the performance of it.
The performance of it.
I think it was, what's your critique of it?
It's like jaunty, you know, it's jaunty. Cheerful.
See, you used to be one of those KZSU DJs. Did you review CDs?
I did review CDs.
Because, you know, we kind of have this thing about reviews where we try to pick CDs that we like and then we describe them, right?
Describe them rather than critiquing them.
Right.
Yeah, that's
we try to stay away from critiques because if it's something we don't like, we just don't play it.
Yeah.
But that's us here. But you used to be one of those DJs. Now, jaunty's an interesting word. Was it the banjo?
Yeah, and his delivery, you know, all that kind of like whooping and it's just, I mean, it's a song about being in prison and like the train is coming, the midnight train, and you know, its light is the only thing that you see that gives you any handle on the outside world, or maybe you're hoping that it will run over you. I don't know. It's like, it's not a happy song.
So in listening to Pete's version, it kind of distracted you in a sense.
Yeah.
It kind of, to you, it kind of took you away from the original purpose of it. Like,
you weren't getting that feeling of
what the song was trying to convey.
Exactly. You know, and we have here a recording of Lead Belly.
Who did the original version of
exactly,
it.
Exactly, singing the same song. And it's interesting, the songs actually, maybe we can listen to just a little bit of it. They sound really similar, but there's something really different about the Lead Belly version. Like the rhythm is the same, you know, got the banjo, but...
Lead Belly lived it.
Exactly. It's totally different.
You know the story about Lead Belly, right? He was in prison for life for murder.
Tell me about
Lead Belly. And we don't know if he did it or not because to an American in the South in the, mm-hmm. in the early 19th century, 20th century, you could get sent to jail for murder for even not doing it. Well, today, that can happen today, too.
Yeah.
he was such a great player and so prolific. Think of this, that the governor pardoned him. The governor heard him play and said, I don't care if you kill the guy or not, man. You know what? Let him out. Huh. Let him out. Let him go play for the people. And he got out because he was such a great player and singer. Now, you know, his music actually conveyed such a power that it moved the governor to pardon him.
Hmm. Let's listen to just a little bit of the Lead Belly version.
Gets up in the morning when that big bell rings. For the march to the devil, you meet the same old thing, not talking on the table. Ain't nothing in my pain. Never say anything about it. Have a trouble with your man. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a heaven loving light on me. If you ever go to Houston, you better walk right, and you better not squabble, and you better not fight. Bet Brocker will arrest you. Hit the boom and take it down. You can bet your bottom dollar that you're Sugarland bound. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a heaven loving light on me. Well, jump a little shoe there. She was a mighty fine girl. She didn't brought jumping. There's a whole round world where she brought it in the morning. Just a wonderful day. Where she brought me the news. And my wife was dead. That started me grieving. We've been hollering and crying. Then I began to worry. About a great long time. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a heaven loving light on me.
Yes, proof, ladies and gentlemen, that nobody does it like the original.
Yeah, that's right.
Would that be the point of this whole conversation we've been having about this song?
I don't know. I mean, I respect Pete Seeger's motivations, but I feel like, the original is the original.
Sure. It's probably always going to be the best. So there you go, Pete.
Poor Pete.
Okay, now, usually at the bottom of the hour, I like to get into what the guest does around here at Stanford. And when I say Stanford, it's the Stanford community, so it's not necessarily always right on campus. But today, Catherine Todd, you're originally from Ukiah.
That's right.
So that's where your parents settled?
I'm sure a lot of people have heard of Ukiah.
Sure.
Oh, come on.
No, really. It's a famous California town.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those California... You know, California is very rich in towns beginning with vowels, especially in the northern part of the state.
I wonder why that is.
Well, there's Ukiah and Yreka, Eureka, and...
Have you ever checked that out? Like, why that might be?
Well, Ukiah is a corruption of the Spanish Yokayo, which is a corruption of the Pomo... Indian word, the Native American word for the place, which means big, deep valley.
Now, there's something that one could get off into and get into some real critiques, huh?
Yeah.
How California used to belong to somebody else, and it wasn't California. It was another place altogether.
Yeah.
And it seems that their ancestors are coming back, kind of reclaiming it.
Well, the history of how that happened is really understudied and
yeah, you're right.
It's so close to us, and so few people know about it.
I was thinking a couple of months ago. I had this kind of epiphany that the Spaniards that came and conquered the Native American people here, well, they came in the late 1500s. Let's say they came in 1600. Well, it wasn't until 1850 that gold was discovered, which brought most of the white Europeans to the West Coast, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's 250 years that the Spaniards had already been here and in with the Native Americans and done what they'd done, you know, and set up their society. And that's about how long we've been here.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah,
real
it's
funny,
true.
You know, they pretty much the Spaniards got pushed out after 250 years. That's a long time to be here. And now we've been here 250 years, and is the Tea Party movement a bunch of white people real nervous about getting pushed out of where they live?
Oh, yeah.
That's another question for another show. We got to talk about you, Catherine Todd. Before you were station manager here, before you had a talk show on KZSU, you were born and raised in Ukiah.
Mm.
And by a couple of hippie parents. Is that too simple?
Oh, well, you know.
They weren't hippies.
You don't want to offend them.
I know I don't. Are they listening?
I would hope not.
I hope so. And they're not hippies. I've never met your parents. I'm sure they're beautiful people. But they raised you in Ukiah. And how was life before you went off to college?
Oh, well, I mean, it was a great place to grow up.
I bet it was.
It's beautiful there, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
it was still here, rural, too, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
And you had a pretty interesting childhood?
Oh, yeah. You know, I grew up by the Russian River, and my brother and I would catch crawdads and tadpoles and spend our whole summer just swimming up and down.
So if your parents really had a dream about having a family, that was probably the place that they really wanted it, the kind of place they really wanted to do it, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
for two people that came out of the city that wanted to go somewhere and kind of get away from the city life.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of a dream of the perfect life, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then you went off to Caltech in Pasadena to study physics and literature.
Yeah.
What brought that on?
Well,
How did you decide to do that?
Caltech is a tech school, right? It's sort of like the smaller West Coast MIT.
Mm-hmm.
And
you had to get accepted there too, right?
Yeah, well.
Did you have like really good grades? Were you into that in high school?
Yeah,
physics and all that?
Yeah, I was one of the nerd kids.
Really?
Yeah.
Heavy in the science projects?
Yeah, yeah.
Used to win the science fair every year?
I don't know. But you know, Caltech was a great place to be a literature major.
Why?
Well, there were so few literature majors, but there was still there were a bunch of literature professors because you had to like civilize the the savage science undergraduates.
Cool.
By making them take these humanities classes, and so, but it I had all these opportunities there. I got to spend a summer studying at the Huntington Research Library, and, you know, studying
Is that a
all
famous
these
library?
Rare books and manuscripts. It's an amazing place.
Oh, wow.
So
was there a point where life split for you and you went more for the physics than the literature?
Well, you know, the thing that I really loved about physics when I was an undergrad and still is it's sort of like this, you know, Thoreauvian dream of the authentic life, right? A lot of people have jobs that are where you get to work with your hands and make something, but you're really disconnected from the idea of how it's made and from having any power over how it's made or deciding exactly how to make it.
Kind of like assembling widgets.
Exactly. And those jobs are no fun, right?
Right.
But a lot of people are sort of on the opposite end where they maybe get to live in the world of ideas, but what they are actually doing with their bodies and their hands is sitting in front of a computer screen. And I thought that was kind of depressing too. And I wanted a job where I could be a person with a mind and a pair of hands. And the really wonderful thing about the kind of physics that I do is that I get to make things and then, you know, poke them and see how they work. And I think that's really fun. I love it that at the end of the day, I've made something. That's one of the things I like best about my job.
Let's talk a little bit about this, too. You went through Stanford, so you graduated from Pasadena Caltech. In Pasadena, and you came to Stanford as a what they call a post-grad, working on your PhD.
Yeah, for graduate school, yeah.
And You got through that. How long did that take?
Oh, gosh. Are you going to make me count?
Is it a lot of years?
It's more than four? It's more than fit on one hand.
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot of years.
Yeah.
And it's probably a... And are there a lot of women in your field?
You know, we're doing okay. There's more of us than there used to be.
So when you first got there?
Well, I went to the American Physical Society meeting in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And it's huge, you know, and a lot of American physicists go to it. And I remember in 2001 that there was no line for the women's bathroom.
That's saying something.
And, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe the convention center was really big or I was just there was a slow time. But this last year in Pittsburgh, there was a line.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So cool. I don't know. That's my very unscientific, informal measure of the progress of women in physics.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. Now, without taking up too much time, because you have brought some wonderful music, I'd just like to pick your brain. We were talking off mic, and you're working on a very interesting project right now.
Yeah, so I'm working on this material called graphene. And what it is you know, your pencil lead is made of graphite, right?
Mm-hmm.
People know what graphite is. And if you look at its structure, its chemical structure, like on an atomic level, what it really is these sheets of carbon atoms. And the carbon atoms are arranged in a honeycomb arrangement, you know, just like in a beehive, the honeycombs are this hexagonal structure. So all the atoms in the sheet are held together really tightly in this honeycomb lattice. But what graphite is sheets and sheets of this piled on top of each other. And the sheets are actually not held together very strongly. And so when you write with a pencil, when you drag your pencil lead across the paper, you're cleaving off sheets of the graphite and leaving them there.
Oh, yeah. So that's why pencils leave a mark.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why graphite is such a good pencil lead, is that it's, you know, it's leaving that stuff there really easily.
And before graphite, did we use lead?
Yeah, I think people used lead before graphite.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Anyway, so a few years ago in like 2003, 2004, people figured out how to cleave off just a single sheet of graphite,
okay,
which they christened graphene. And it turns out that it has these really interesting electrical properties, and that's what I've been studying. But the crazy thing, the way that they make it, you're going to laugh, it involves scotch tape.
Really?
Yeah. So you take the way that we make it in our lab, and there are different ways and ways now that are maybe more practical for the semiconductor industry being developed. But the way that we traditionally have made it, that we learned from these people in Manchester in the UK who first made this stuff, is that you take chunks of graphite and you put it on scotch tape and you begin folding the tape. And every time you fold and peel away the two sides of the tape, you're cleaving apart those sheets in the graphite crystal.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've done that like several times, you've cleaved it many, many times, you put it down on some silicon chip, and if you're really lucky, somewhere on that chip you'll have just a single sheet of graphite, of graphene.
And this has to be done on a very small level, right? Underneath a microscope or something?
Yeah, yeah. The flakes are, to a person who studies small things, they're really big, but to a person who lives in the real world, they're pretty small. You need a microscope to see them.
Yeah, tiny stuff.
Yeah, right? They're about a thousandth or a hundredth of a centimeter across.
Wow. Yeah. That's really small.
Oh, it's huge.
And so you go to the lab every day and you're working on this project, and the project is to take graphene.
So the idea is that, remember back in the 1990s when you would go and buy a computer, and every time you got a new computer, it would be faster, right? Like, mm-hmm. Now the processor is a gigahertz. Oh, now it's 1.2 gigahertz, right?
So they could sell you more stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But so you never hear now, like none of the computer companies are advertising how fast their chips are.
Why is that?
Well, the reason for that is that they're not getting any faster anymore.
How come?
So, the silicon, which is what your computer chips are made out of,
mm-hmm.
It has some, you know, quantity that we call resistance, which is basically if you like put an electric current through some material, how much of the energy in that current are you losing to heat? Because at some super tiny submicroscopic level, the electrons are like bouncing off of impurities and generating heat that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out, you know, when like the fan in your laptop starts whirring and, you know, your computer is like, you know, keeping your lap nice and warm, that mm-hmm. basically it's that the electrons going through your transistors are not, you know, making it through. They're like bouncing around and generating heat instead. And that is what is keeping them from making faster and faster transistors, because the faster you run your transistor, the more heat you're generating.
And then the heat slows it down.
Well, yeah, the heat, I mean, eventually it's getting pretty close to where your like chips are, you know, melting and stuff. I mean, they get really hot in there.
So do you guys think that graphene could be the answer to the silicon problem?
So graphene has lower resistance than silicon by mm-hmm. quite a lot. And
will it conduct though?
Yeah. I mean, it conducts really well. The problem is that it conducts too well. Like the way that a silicon transistor works, you know, like digital logic, it's like zero or one, it's on or off.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of a transistor is that you have something that you can flip a switch and current goes through, or flip a switch and current doesn't go through.
Okay.
And the problem with graphene actually is that like the current always wants to go through whether you flip the switch or not.
Oh.
And so what the thing that I worked on during my PhD was doing some tricks to try to make it so that graphene would act like a good transistor, so that you could turn off the current flow through it. And it turns out that if you carve it into really narrow structures, like a 10 times a billionth of a meter wide.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you can actually turn off the current flow through it.
Did you guys have to invent a tool to do that?
Oh, no. So, you know, this is actually an old tool and one that's used in the semiconductor industry. It seems crazy, but it's actually not that hard to make structures that are this size.
1 billionth of a...
Well, not 1 billionth, but 10 times a billionth. 1 billionth is hard. Yeah. I studied the way in which these did or didn't really act like a good transistor. It turns out people were really worried about disorder at the edges of these structures. You know, the fact that it's not like what you would really like is to have the edge look like you just like cut that lattice. So you have some beautiful edge that's zigzagging back and forth, or making, you know, like the edge is just like the lattice.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out
not a straight edge.
Yeah. It's like you know, it's as straight as it can be and still be made up of that honeycomb structure.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that what's much more practical and easier to make, what people know how to make, is something that's really kind of disordered and messed up and has peninsulas going in and out. And people were really worried about that kind of disorder and how that would affect the properties of these ribbons. But it actually turns out that there's another kind of disorder that we think really matters a lot, which is that you have schmutz like sitting on top of them. And anyway, that's what I studied during my PhD. And I guess if you're all like looking to invest in something, if someone comes and sells you a story about graphene transistors and how they are the material of the future, I'd be a little skeptical.
Okay.
Yeah.
Getting it from the horse's mouth. Catherine Todd, our guest today for the hour, and you've brought great music too, and we don't want to talk too much. We'd like to play some music. What else do we have for the folks?
Well, I guess I'm done with my musical polemics for the day.
Good.
I the rest of the music that I brought is just music that I like.
Oh, great. You mean not songs that you hate?
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, I got married this year.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And so the music that I've been thinking about lately was, you know, I was like making a playlist. I was like, what music is really appropriate, like marrying music?
Mm-hmm.
So I had two playlists. I had like the music that was like totally inappropriate for a wedding. And then I couldn't bring that today because it was not really so appropriate for daytime radio.
Okay.
But I did bring some of the music that I thought was really appropriate for a wedding. So that's the track I have queued up now.
Who is it?
It's Jolie Holland from the album The Living and the Dead. It's called You Painted Yourself In.
You paint the floor back up in the corner, and when the floor is shiny and wet, you have no choice but to rise over the painted trap that you have set. So place your foot up on the air and climb upon that invisible stair. And when you rise into the world, remember that's exactly the place you painted yourself in. You painted yourself in. You have no choice except but to fly. So fly on invisible wings until you reach your secret home. And when you lay your weary head down, dream a dream of the suffering world you painted yourself in. You painted yourself in. You have no choice except but to fly. So fly.
Let the love tear us apart. I found the cure for a broken heart.
is how it works. It feels a little worse than when we drove our hearse right through that screaming crowd, while laughing up a storm until we were just bone. Until it got so warm that none of us could sleep, and all the styrofoam began to melt away. We tried to find some worms to aid in the decay, but none of them were home inside the catacomb. A million ancient bees began to sting our knees while we were on our knees praying that disease would leave the ones we love and never come again. On the radio we heard November rain. That solo's real long, but it's a pretty song. We listened to it twice because the DJ was asleep. Bum, ba, bum, ba, bum. This is how it works. You're young until you're not. You love until you don't. You try until you can't. You peer inside yourself. You take the things you like, then try to love the things you took. And then you take that love you made and stick it into someone else's heart, pumping someone else's blood and walking arm in arm. You hope it don't get harmed, but even if it does, you just do it all again. And on the radio you'll hear November rain. That solo's awful long, but it's a good refrain. You'll listen to it twice, 'cause the DJ is asleep. On the radio, on the radio, on the radio, uh-oh. On the radio, uh-oh. On the radio, uh-oh. On the radio.
Okay, back with Catherine Todd, and you know, radio time goes so fast. You used to do an hour here weekly, and you remember how fast it went, right?
Oh, so slowly.
I know, didn't it? Slowly. It's over.
That's true.
Where did the time go? We had three words, and that was it?
Yeah, we hardly talked at all.
Who was that? We hardly argued at all.
Yeah, that's
right. Who was that we just heard
that
from?
That was Regina Spektor. The song was On the Radio from the album Begin to Hope, and that's one of the songs that I've been kind of listening to obsessively over and over on repeat lately. But I sort of have a weakness for puns, so I wanted to play the song called On the Radio.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And did you play that at your wedding?
No, it wasn't actually part of the like wedding appropriate songs.
Oh, okay. But the song before that?
The song before that and the song before. So one of the two songs before that, the Jolie Holland, and then the next one was the Wombats, mm-hmm. Which is a British sort of they're like a teen pop band. But the song was called Let's Dance to Joy Division, which was maybe sort of obvious from the lyrics. Anyway, that was my husband's favorite wedding song.
Okay.
And the one before that was mine.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Catherine, this has been a most exhilarating hour.
I've had a really good time.
I have too.
I always love talking to you.
Oh,
Bird.
Thank you. I enjoyed you when you were doing your show here and station manager, and it's great to have you back. And please come back again.
Oh well, I would love to sometime.
Okay, and what are we going to go out with?
You know, this is a Tom Waits song called Cold, Cold Ground.
If folks want to get a hold of you about your work or your music or anything else, can they?
Yeah, I suppose they could.
How would they do that?
Well, I guess that I have an email address at KZSU.
You do?
I do, yeah.
So Catherine Todd at KZSU?
I think it's KATHRYNT at KZSU.stanford.edu.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks once again.
Thanks for having me on. It was really fun.
You're totally welcome. And stay in touch, too, okay?
Sure thing.
All right.
Fallen side kick in an old cafe. Never slept with a dream before you had to go away. There's a bell in the tower, Uncle Ray bought around. Don't worry about the army in the cold, cold ground. Cold, cold ground. Cold, cold ground. Cold, cold ground. Now don't be a cry, baby. There's wood in the shed, there's a bird in the chimney and a stone in my bed. When the road's washed out, we pass the bottle around and wait in the arms of the cold, cold ground. The cold, cold ground. The cold, cold ground. The cold, cold ground. There's a ribbon in the willow, there's a tire swing rope. Briar patch of berries taking over the slope. The cattle sleep in the mailbox and we'll never go to town till we bury every dream in the cold, cold ground. In the cold, cold ground. The cold, cold ground. In the cold, cold ground.
Break all the windows in the cold, cold ground.